Hello, Bob.
Hey, Ben. Great to be back.
27th chat.
2 and 7 is 9. That's a good number.
Mm-hmm.
I announced on... I was on the radio with Jerry Fiocca in L.A., and I announced that Finnegan's Wake on a key initiatory level, initiating, original, is that Joyce, and this is not known, Joyce was angry at what Dante had created, this whole notion of hell. And he figured the Christian church did not have that notion before Dante. And then the printing press spread around. So he was really angry at the meme that Dante's Divine Comedy created.
This would fit completely.
You want to make fun of all
that
stuff.
Yeah, I'd back you up. This would fit completely with my understanding of Joyce, because there's a whole, like nearly a fifth of his first published novel, Portrait of the Artist as Young Man, is a long sermon about hell, and it's put there as a horrific example of what the Catholic Church does to young minds, and it occupies a fifth of the book, a lecture about hell. So obviously he thought about how hell was used and how it bullied and frightened young people and what a horror it was. So it doesn't surprise me at all what you're saying about his later work.
Yes, and so it starts around a wake, and Joyce is making fun of people sitting around trying to commune with the dead and all that the wake traditionally represented in the Christian level. So you have no problem with that idea. I just wanted to put it out there, and it's good you reminded me. Yes, the hell is a big thing now in Portrait of the Artist. Now, here's an interesting point to show you the difference between maybe Karl Marx and McLuhan, is that McLuhan used to say that we need those kind of sermons today in the church. Now, that's pretty, from your view, pretty reactionary and pretty opposite to what you think Joyce's agenda is.
Well, I have to say that in the trio of Frank Zappa, Marshall McLuhan and Karl Marx we have, the fact that McLuhan was a member of the Roman Catholic Church really sticks out like a sore thumb. I think that Marx and Zappa kind of gang up on the anti-religious, you know, connection. Marx says all thinking, all critical thinking, begins with the critique of religion, and that's pretty much how Frank starts. The attacking religion is where he starts from. So I find Marshall McLuhan's turn to religion, you know, it's him out in the cold.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that was a major problem for the secular humanists who gravitate towards McLuhan in the 60s, but when they found out about his Catholicism, they dropped him. And he was not spiritually correct, I guess you'd say. Religiously correct. So, but what's interesting is that, in spite of that, his insights into Joyce are pretty good. But it's probably insights that no one would agree with. No one agrees in the media. No one agrees with the media analysis of Finnegan's Wake by McLuhan, except one person, Stephen Joyce, Joyce's grandson, says that Eric McLuhan's work on Finnegan's Wake, his book's called The Roll of Thunder in Finnegan's Wake. It's about the 10 thunders and the technological underpinnings. You can get a basic map of the McLuhan's interpretation of the 10 thunders in the book War and Peace in the Global Village, which is still just circulated and distributed in stores. Came out in 68, but it's available. If you want to see how the McLuhans interpreted Finnegan's Wake's 10 thunders. But James Joyce was amazed by it. And of course, though, in the Joyce industry, scholars are angry that Stephen won't let them access to some stuff, and he polices books on Joyce in some way. Eric does that. Well, what happened is the Joyce Quarterly started a controversy, and the scholars were ganging up on Stephen, and Eric McLuhan wrote in and defended Stephen, because he said, I'm in the same position. There's scholars ripping off McLuhan all the time. So many people think that Stephen Joyce likes Eric's book only for the provisional reasons that they're on the same side in the battle with the Joyce estate versus the scholars. And so there may be no weight behind what Steve says. But I would agree with Stephen that Eric's its way of looking at the Joyce is, aside from the tongue playing that you do with it, and that's valid, there's a larger applied Joyce that one can use in a revolution.
I would call it actually work for the tongue rather than play. in the sense that if you read out Finnegan's Wake, it's not a free-for-all where you can tongue it any way you like. It's forcing your tongue into very definite positions. It's a score for a musical interpretation, and it's not a random score. It's extremely definite where each letter is, and in seeking to read it, you're forced to do all kinds of things to your mouth, which are highly pleasurable, and everyone should do.
No, it's like an artist. When he's painting, he's not really a play, he's partly a work. He's in between play and work, and that's what you're saying.
And just to get back to the gist of what you were saying, the reason you started talking about Eric and Stephen and everything, which is in the 60s, radical people were put off McLuhan because they found out that he was formerly a member of the Roman Catholic, formerly in the sense of the formal sense, an actual member of the Roman Catholic Church. But what interests me about that is that this allowed him to have insights into James Joyce that maybe secular interpreters will miss. It connects him to Frank Zappa, because Frank Zappa was brought up as a Catholic and reacted against it. And it connects them to Guy Debord, who was very influenced by reading Hootzinger on the Middle Ages, a book called The Waning of the Middle Ages, which is an anti-capitalist book celebrating what existed before Protestantism and capitalism kind of took over the running of the world, became the rationality of the world. And understanding what the Middle Ages is something that maybe requires, you know, maybe that's McLuhan's dodgy kowtowing to the Pope, which I mean, you know, I'd have a row with McLuhan about that. I don't like a lot of the things that the Pope says. And
neither did McLuhan.
Yeah,
he was very
critical
of the church, but he loved Hosea's book.
He liked Hootzinger's book. And the point is that a sympathy with and an understanding of what society was before money became the ruling ruling medium for understanding relations between people, that money became the most important means. If you can understand a society, what society was like before then, you start to get in a properly critical relationship to what money is now, instead of just having a moral reaction against it and saying, well, we ought not to be into money. If you can actually imagine a society before money took over, then I think you can imagine a society after money, we've been through money. And that's the importance of medievalism, of sympathy with the medieval world, and why Rabelais is still an incredibly important writer for people to read. Because everybody, the usual way in which we talk about the modern system is of rampant greed, rampant indulgence taking over. The problem with the modern world is everybody gets what they want, and they get it too fast, and it's kind of doing them in. They're eating too much sugar, they're watching too much porn, they're pleasuring themselves too much. Now, if you are aware of the Middle Ages and Rabelais, and you understand that actually money is all about deferred pleasure, that the system that we're in is all about rejecting things for their actual sensual moment now, and always calculating about the status they give you in society for some kind of later reward. And so that what current ideology, current normal common sense is about, as promoted by the mass media and all the systems that I would call capitalism, is about is spreading an idea of deferral of pleasure, of not having it in the instant, but of worrying about where your status is, which in the end becomes very unsensual and unimmediate, because you're always worrying about your theoretical position and deferring actual bodily pleasure. So this medievalism can become an incredibly important criticism of what we've got now, and not reactionary at all. It's actually the thing that can smash away a lot of the things which are being pushed at us now.
No, that's exactly it. It's interesting that Huizinga used, how do you say it?
Huizinga? I say it, he's Dutch. I mean, it's spelt
H-U-I
Huizinga, but the Dutch pronounce it Hootzinger. Okay, H-U-I-Z-I-N-G-E-R. So it's H-U-I, Hui, and then Zinger, pronounced Hootzinger. The waning of the Middle Ages, yeah.
Yeah, the way he, for a left perspective, appreciated the importance of the Middle Ages for a model to understand capitalism. And then McLuhan had the same take on it and knew the value of the medieval environment for, I would say, non-communist purposes, non-socialist. So it's interesting you have, what is that? The model is good, and it's so good, is that great art? Anybody can use it for their provincial purposes. Isn't that? And then Finnegan's Wake includes everybody. It actually wakes up that fact right in front of you, which then makes it, nobody can respond to it, maybe.
Mm.
What do you think of that?
Well, here you're defining political positions as kind of a kind of identity. And you see, I think the way I'd make a distinction, being left-wing or right-wing, being a Marxist is not about having an identity. It's about criticizing identity. So if you understand what Marx is arguing, you actually read Marx, which a lot of the people who make statements about being left and right and everything don't actually read Marx. What you find is a mind that's alive to the problems of fetishism and reification and alienation and the things which turn thought into its opposite. So I'm not, you know, in being, yeah, I do define myself as a socialist and left-wing and Marxist, but I don't think that makes me limited in the way I can respond to things.
You would you recommend, I understand you have a postal strike over there right now?
Yeah, well, there's an ongoing dispute which occasionally erupts in strikes, yeah.
Oh, okay. Would what we're discussing today be useful to the strikers?
I think so, because I'd understand what's going on as part of the neoliberal program, that it's not simply this government making a mistake in its policy. It's the International Monetary Fund is telling Britain that it's got to privatise more, it's got to show profit margins increasing, or they're not going to grant leeway with debts and capital and so on. So encouraging, getting people to realise that these, what they might be told are parochial disputes, are actually working out a global problem, that it's connected with a global problem, and that it's a historical problem, and that everything is connected to everything else, in the sense that the problem of capitalism that the post office workers are fighting is the same problem of capitalism that James Joyce was wrestling with, imperialism in Ireland and so on. All these things connect, that there is no sort of separations which are worth maintaining between literature and politics and your life and your own ability to buy money. I mean, every time you go into a shop, you're actually falling under the law of value, which is a capitalist system. So you're partaking of the universal all the time. And yet this universalism is disguised so that you don't have a blissful feeling of global connection when you go into a shop. You go in and feel, well, I haven't got quite enough money, and here's this thing which is rather poor quality, and, you know, it's a kind of usually a fairly miserable experience, which it shouldn't be. And I think our arguments about bringing this universality to consciousness so that people understand how the infrastructure which capitalism has worked out is absolutely extraordinary, that we're in touch with people all over the world, these products coming from China, but we lack the communication systems to push through the moral or the ethical things that we'd like to agree with through to actually running the system. The system is still barbaric.
Yeah, that's why you thought Zappa was aware of this. What did he call himself? The International Mutations? What was the name of that company?
He wanted the United Mutations. He had an idea of...
not United, later International Absurdities.
Right? Intercontinental Absurdities. In which I always think he slightly meant incontinental absurdities, which meant not having control over your excreta anymore, because Frank Zappa was certain that what the world needed was an enema and that they were repressed and their bodily functions were blocked, and that what they needed was to let things out, which is a typical 60s point of view and regularly dismissed and derided in current media as being a 60s idea. It's in fact... perceptive about the situation that we're still in But this, the unblocking has to be a total unblocking, and if it's partial, then it merely adds to the central block.
I would say that the reason that the weight of that theme of the 60s diminished is that people added on the TV body and the chip body, so the chemical body's issues became not so important or pressing, so that would obsolesce Reich, at least would explain why people don't think that's important at all. Now, we need to make them aware of their chip body and TV body, and then they could recover their chemical body, which they might be neglecting, and then you could retrieve Reich.
Yeah,
I just want to say that. But back to the point about Zappa, he was aware of the international power of pop music, rock music, and he was trying to point out the whole world, the involvement of everybody, and so that, I would say, he was relevant to the Socialist International.
Well, this has been my particular axe, which I've been grinding for the last 30 years, is arguing that there is no... there should be no distinction between your aesthetics and your politics, and I chose Zappa as being an extreme example of something that would be worth making everybody argue about. And I gave a lecture on Frank Zappa at the conference of the Socialist Workers Party, and upset a lot of people by my absolute enthusiasm for someone that it's quite easy for the left to caricature as a right-wing person. He didn't repeat left-wing the usual left-wing phrases, and in many ways was proud to be a capitalist. And my point was, we have to look at the real effect of what someone does on the world rather than their agreeing with an identity which you then say, well, they're on our side. And to that extent, I'm in sympathy with you see, I think if a left-wing politics defines itself as an identity, it becomes corrupt, because I think a real Marxist is trying to understand how the world is conflicting, why the world is in conflict, what these conflicts are, and it seeks to explain what these are to the participants so that we can work towards something better. It's not about setting up a system of, well, I like this and I'm therefore against all the people who don't like this and I'll exterminate them, or some kind of warfare on that level. It is about enlightenment and understanding, and this is the I see Marx as the best product of the Enlightenment. But the Enlightenment as a movement, a movement of the 17th century, has been so under attack by modern trendy thinkers as being the origin of all evil, that if you go and study the humanities these days, you're told the Enlightenment, oh, they're oppressive, they're bad, they want to rationalize everything, they're awful, you know. And I find it immediately enters a paradoxical argument, because if you're there studying something and trying to understand it, you don't want to be enlightened. Well, we want to be darkened. You know, the common sense just revolts for me against this kind of double thinking that we're all forced to do. But this idea that it's actually the Enlightenment that we want to understand more, I hold on to, and that's one thing I admired about Frank, is that that's really where he stood.
Yeah, so one, I've got piled up statements here. Just hold on for a second. First of all, that McLuhan was against capitalism too, so that's interesting. He wasn't a capitalist, he wasn't for it. Then Zappa, okay, what do I want to say about Zappa? Zappa, just a second now. So McLuhan was that. Oh yeah, you have said before, I've heard you say it, that Zappa completed the work of Finnegan's Wake, or carried it on. I don't think any Joycean other than me had ever thought of that. Have you ever gotten a reaction to that?
I've only been able to find enthusiasts for James Joyce among Zappa fans. I've never been able to find Zappa fans among Joyceans.
Okay, and now, the next theme... the Enlightenment. Why do people turn against it now, or last 30, 40 years? I think that's where it's useful to bring in McLuhan. That was the book, the printed book was being spread, it educated people, and Voltaire and those guys wrote in on that, and that is that. Then you come into the media world of, mixed media world of the last 30 years, and the book is a weaker medium, and all of academia falls under the sway of the electric effect and starts knocking the concepts of the Enlightenment, but they really mean the medium and its limitations, the disservice of the medium. And that's why when you get confused about their knocking enlightened, being enlightened, you got to bring in the media dynamic as a substructure. That clarifies our critique of the postmodernists who are falling prey to the electric effect.
Yeah, well, this brings me to what I've been thinking about this week in conjunction with our conversations, that what we are really trying to grasp the nettle of what it is to be a culture person who's read a lot and thinks and understands the power of Elvis Presley. What is that and how to talk about it? And we are not part of what seems to me the false solution to it, which is going to squirmingly embarrassing lectures where somebody develops a cultural theory which thinks it can deal with these issues, and that there's a lot of false dealing with this that is embarrassing actually to expose yourself to, and that I want some way of dealing with these different forces on me that doesn't sell out the power either of thinking or of what a record gives me, that doesn't put one below the other, because I think you can learn as much, not necessarily from Elvis, although at certain points in my life I think I've learned tons from Elvis, but for me, if we take a serious look at one track by Johnny Guitar Watson, we can actually, from its position and its the politics generated by his social being, by the way he saw the world as somebody whose parents emigrated to the West from Texas to work in the new industries that were developing because of the war industry in the 40s and later the 50s boom, and his perspective on the world and what he thought was valuable and not valuable, that you can learn from these that they are powerful foundation stones for a strong view of the world, that you take them seriously and you don't patronize them by saying they have a relationship to intellectual or political ideas. It's not about patronizing them or stealing just their aura. It's about taking seriously what they're saying, to the extent to which you feel you could actually face that person and have a discussion with them. And that's something that I've noticed, that a lot of the academics who pretend to deal with pop culture are completely incapable of doing, you know, because they'll only talk to people who can parrot back their jargon. They can't actually speak in a way that you could hope an ordinary radio listening audience could understand.
Well, there you bring in the radio audience. You're talking about people, POBs, printing oriented bastards, McLuhan called them, that would think is limited to the book medium, and you write a paper in an academic conference and present a conceptual framework that is so puny that you're ignoring that there's radio going on all around you and more people are hearing ideas there. Yeah. And an idea doesn't have to be logically presented. It can be a mood, an atmosphere, an attitude. And that's what you see in Johnny Guitar Watson. And that's communicating immediately. And to miss that, you are a print fundamentalist.
Yeah, but that's
back there.
That's great.
I don't mean you,
Bob. But that's a great thing to throw at the POBs. That's fantastic. But still, tell me how McLuhan responded or dealt with the people who managed to get in control of the new technologies and dominate them. Because I presume he's not particularly happy with the way they're being run.
Exactly. You know what he did? He wrote books. In his books, he said in the 50s, he writes a couple of essays on this, he said he noticed that there's a whole new world with television by the middle of 50s. And this is changing people. It's a big factor in the continuation of capitalism and communism and everything. So he said, what is the role of the book in this? How can, and he taught English, you know, he was a book person. That was his job and role. He really looked seriously at what can a book do today. And he decided that Finnegan's Wake was the only book that took on this situation. But he knew that was such an esoteric situation back then, 50 years ago, that he translated Finnegan's Wake. And he wrote his books in the style of Finnegan's Wake, not the verbal stream collage, but the message of larger media dynamics and landscapes. That's what he did. And so he thought his books were a way to bring in thinking, but he would not limit to offering a conceptual theory. That's why he said he developed percepts.
In the light of that, it's very easy for me to explain to you why I see Frank Zappa as the continuation and completion of the work of James Joyce, because what Frank Zappa created was a deliberate audio-visual collage that was available in record form with the cover, in which every facet in it is put there on purpose in order to cast strange light upon the use of those things elsewhere. So that there's always a mismatch between how Zappa's using something and what it is in the actual world, which leads you to look through it to see what the actual world is. So that what you're, and I think the useful, the other thing that you've got to put in there is Kurt Schwitters and his Dada collages, because it's a matter of finding that every fragment of rubbish that exists around the world, around you, because they've been produced as part of a universalizing capitalist system, are all pregnant with universal values, and there can be no irrelevance. And this is where I'd throw Prynne in as important as well, that it's proceeding on the basis that you cannot be irrelevant and you cannot not communicate. So all these problems that people say they have with art, which is incommunicable and not communicating, are all people trying to manage communication to support the current system. And therefore, actual incomprehension is impossible. But what you do have is people who can pile up materials which allow you to look into them and discover the universal for yourself. And that pile of materials is Finnegan's Wake, and that pile of materials is Frank Zappa's oeuvre. And I don't think there are that many artists who've concreted what I'm talking about. It's a very unique thing to be able to do, in which you can, in navigating them, become more yourself than you were before. Most artistic projects, actually, you have to surrender yourself to them and you become like them. I think the more you use Finnegan's Wake and the more you use Zappa, the more you're able to express what your particular viewpoint on the universe is.
Yeah, on my tiny note chart, you will see that I put McLuhan and Zappa together for a certain era in the 60s, and they're equal. Now, what was common to them is that while McLuhan was writing books, whenever the opportunity came up, he put out a record or a movie. And it's like Zappa's line, I will use any available medium. The point is that they were not identifying with any particular medium, and they could work in any medium to bring their message forward. That's the common thing between Joyce, McLuhan, and Zappa. And was Karl Marx able to be categorized like that, or it's too early in the media dynamic for Karl Marx?
Well, the way I connect them would be, and I'm not sure, I'm interested to know how you'll respond to this, which is one way of explaining that perversity, in a way, on the part of Zappa and McLuhan. They're gathering a whole lot of people who are expecting a lecture in words, and they show them a film, or that kind of sidestepping what they expect. I'd say is to give people an experience that it is a... I mean, R.D. Lang published a famous book called The Politics of Experience in the 60s, and experience, Jimi Hendrix experience, is a big word in the 60s, and I noticed that it's very fashionable now to decry experience and say we are all post-cybernetic people, and to hang on to experiences, to hang on to some neo-romantic reactionary idea. But when you're saying that, what we're doing is we're saying that to fetishize a particular jargon or a particular moment in the glass bead game of culture is completely wrong, because what we're interested in is the experience at the level of the universal human being, or the animals that are human beings.
And that includes what you said. Oh, a side note. The lecture you gave at the Social Workers Party or whatever, was that in May 2008 when they did the anniversary of 68? Is that the lecture?
That's not what I'm talking about. It was longer ago than that. It was in...
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, okay, now...
But okay, I mean, I don't think there's a duty. You see, I don't, Bob, I don't think there's a duty forever to always be perverse. the kind of interpretation that we get from that is absolutely current in the art schools, where it's always a coup if you're expected to do one thing and you go and perversely do the other thing. And this has become a kind of boring tic among modern artists, where they've always got to do the unexpected, and it becomes so pat that it becomes exactly what you expect them to do. They'll always come forward and, you know, they'll print it backwards, or they'll print it upside down, or they'll print white on white so you can't read it. And all these things, to me, are so much garbage. I mean, it might have been thought that I was agreeing with those people earlier on when I was saying what I was saying, but actually I completely disagree with them. And I think the most interesting, perverse thing to do now is actually to lob in communicative truth. That's the one thing that everybody's leaving out.
You mean Habermas? You don't mean Habermas.
Well, no, because Habermas thinks it's possible to develop a situation in which communicative truth is happening between people in a dialogic sense. I don't think it is. I think communicative truth creates a shock, which creates conflict. In my experience, every time I've said anything true, it's pissed off hundreds of people straight away. And
okay. Now, I was going to say something resonant with what you're talking about right now. I'm glad you did this. I was going to, about 4 minutes ago, say, Ben, when I was at your place in April 2008, one night you said to me, we came in from outside, and you said, I hate Frank Zappa. Now, that bonded me with you, because that is what we're talking about. We're not going to get stuck with Frank or McClone or anybody today, necessarily.
You know,
it's looking at what's happening now, as you say, now and everything.
And realizing why you like things, that we liked Zappa against this. We didn't like him as against ourselves. We liked him as against Bob Dylan. We liked him as against Janis Joplin. We liked him as against, you know, that was the options at the time. That's what he means. But to grab onto him and hold him in front of your face while you're doing everything is actually to blind yourself.
Yeah, I really like what McLuhan said back in the 60s. He said, people think if I talk about something, I'm for it. And I've always been accused of being a McLuhanite. If people knew me, I'm not a McLuhanite. I could criticize McLuhan and think he's a jerk on many levels as much as I thought Zappa was a jerk, but in different contexts.
But the context, you're interesting about McLuhan, because you're always producing a McLuhan. You keep producing a McLuhan that surprises and interests me. So you keep saying, no, the interesting thing about McLuhan is how it would reply to that remark or that specific thing. This actually goes in this way. Yeah.
See, in my approach is that I have, McLuhan once said, I've been collecting ammunition. This is a letter to Ezra Pound in 1951. I've been collecting ammunition for 20 years, and I intend to use it. So when you're interacting with me, I've got McLuhan, I've got Zappa, I've got Joyce, Wyndham Lewis, and a lot of other things that are my ammunition, which will always be there to present something to you or anybody that you had not thought about, that I know you don't know.
Yeah, well,
and
that's
then
fine.
How they respond to that determines how long I hang around.
I mean, the way I put Marx in there would be
Let's go back to Marx.
It's to do with fundamental orientations and understanding of what's wrong with Western civilization. And it's understanding that there's been a battle throughout Western civilization between idealism and materialism. And this perception, for me, is so strong. It's so useful to decoding all the conflicts that I see around me, that I want to use it. Of course, if I use these terms, I get cast as someone who's simply repeating the same vocabulary and fitting everything back. And what I seek to do is to try and explain how, without knowing it, a progressive idea is always on the side of everyday life versus the word from on high.
It's now and everything. Yeah. If you know that people don't think much about Marx too much anymore, so you're going to bring that in so that their minds include everything, and that they shouldn't have forgotten the services of Marx.
Yeah.
Now, did Marx, he was available for everything. He used all the media. He did lectures, he did radicalism, he showed up at strikes, and he did everything that was available, right?
Well, theatre was particularly important for him and his daughter Eleanor Marx, and they were involved with the whole fever for Ibsen, for Henrik Ibsen and his plays, which was kind of like punk rock at the time. It was like this; these plays were shocking so realistic that people fainted when they went to see the plays, and they were about sexual impropriety, and they were about the evil things which rich people had done, and things which just seem like average plots to us today. But it was the Ibsen movement was huge, and it's the connection between Marx and Joyce is this passion for Ibsen, because that's where Joyce starts. He loves Ibsen, and it's Ibsen's attack on religious hypocrisy which was particularly important for the young James Joyce. The attack on religious hypocrisy, particularly around sexual matters, and Marx was completely taken with the whole Ibsen thing. I mean, he loved Shakespeare as well, but plays. And you can see with Eleanor Marx, who was also a speaker, a political speaker, that the difference between acting and speaking from the podium to strikers is not that different, not because you're acting when you're doing politics, but more because standing in front of people and saying things and affecting them is this incredibly powerful mechanism. Now, I can't stand theatre. I mean, I'm going through a particular thing at the moment where we're got involved every week with taking the family and getting involved with theatre, and it's reminding me of how much I dislike theatre, because I used to think it was because other means have taken over, but actually it's because theatre now is a decadent form that assumes that it's a representation outside of real life. And the way that Marx and Eleanor Marx are seeing theatre is a way of directly operating on people's consciousness. It's something you can do in a room, and so it's more like what I would see as free improvisation or an event during a demonstration or something like that.
So that's what Marx, you're saying that free improvisation is acceptable theater for you?
I don't see it as theater. What I'm saying is that you're asking me, does Marx use any means possible? And I mean, I think so. I mean, for him, the understanding of what money is doing to the world is more important than any particular means of combating it.
You know,
but he had an idea of theory, which has actually been adopted by academia in a really unpleasant way, which is the idea of, if you write a long book, you've worked out the key to the world, and this is the problematic legacy of Capital, which is he took an incredible amount of very detailed argument in Capital to show how false the money relation actually is, and it's logical, and it's a kind of logic that isn't taught in logic books in philosophy, so philosophers find it hard. Everyone has to begin again when you read Capital. It's re-educating yourself. It's its own personal new logic. It's not something that if you know philosophy or you know economics, in fact, the more bourgeois economics you know, the less you can read Capital, the harder it is for you to understand it. Because it's step by step showing you that the money system, which pretends to be an exchange of equals, there's a special thing in it called labour, which is what we do or what we're paid to do, which is not a fair exchange, that cannot be a fair exchange in a money system, that there's some flaw in the money system about evaluating what is socially necessary work for the society to work. It can't evaluate it properly, and it will lead to crises and wars and starvation and all the atrocities which occurred actually after Marx, you know, he predicted it, and probably the main atrocities of capitalism occurred in the 20th century after he died. So it's a way of explaining why this money system doesn't work. And he had to invent his own logic. It's based on Hegel, but he extended it in order to to reconcile what he was observing with the failure of a normal rationality to interpret it. So if you're going to invent a new way of thinking, it's going to be a fairly intensive thing to ask somebody to go through, which is what you go through if you become a Marxist.
Now, what is your problem with theatre? I don't know if I got that. And relate that to your free improvisation.
My problem with theatre today is it's watching
medium?
People... I think Sid Vicious put it best when he just said, what is this, all this Hollywood stuff, all these people pretending to be something? And Sid Vicious was somebody who very dramatically understood that his everyday life was a performance because of the fame of the Sex Pistols and because of the special position he was in. And he could see how dramatic and extraordinary it was that he, you know, ripped his shirt or cut his chest, and suddenly there's all these photographs and it has this huge effect. So obviously the idea of theatre as this careful reproduction of the world in a special room just seems really old-fashioned and parochial. But when he said that about Hollywood actors, you know, why can't, you know, what are they doing pretending to be someone else, actually hit the nail on the head for me for what's wrong with so much of Hollywood, which is the Robert De Niro problem. You know, somebody training themselves to act like somebody else. You know, I'll act like a lunatic. And if you know any lunatics or you've been a lunatic, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is the most insulting pile of patronising crap you've ever seen in your life. You can't believe it. You can't even sit through it, actually. You can't judge it because it's so horrible. And I thought Sid Vicious really nailed that. But in the reverse sense, he also praised the best of Hollywood, which is John Wayne or Robert Mitchum. These people who don't act at all. They're just people. They just sort of ride horses and grunt and just do what they do. And they're the best people to watch because they're not acting. And so it's the relationship between... It's because the bourgeois system invents a kind of art which represents the world, and you're meant to accept that as a representation. Whereas for me, pertinent art doesn't accept representation. It realises it's Brechtian. It understands what we are. We are people representing something on stage. We come in, we say things to you, we want you to react. We're doing something to you.
So why... Is it worth trying to figure out why Western human beings capitulated to capital 200 years ago? Why didn't they recognize and organize? Or did they, and the mafias beat them down? Like, how do you, why are people, quote, stupid about this point?
Well, the people get their particular way of life and the way they've organized it often depends upon this system. I mean, you know, they're deeply fond of it, that, and they believe their life would be...
So the system grew around them, and they didn't know the implications of it. What is it, and this is what McLuhan's always analyzing, what is it that made the system grow around people and they didn't foresee the cage would put them in? Why did they adopt it? It must have been a novelty. And then I relate to Sid Vicious. People like movies... It's not really people pretending. It's the medium itself, the great light sound experience.
Well, I mean, that's the great thing about a film, is this absolutely huge screen and the colour zooming at you and the music and the experience of it, which is still fantastic. I mean, I agree with Guy Debord's way of seeing films. You should break into the back of cinemas, watch 10 minutes of one film, then go to another and watch 10 minutes of another. Not follow plot or all this kind of theatrical stuff that it's all dressed up in, but actually go and experience what these huge moving photographs on walls are doing, you know, which is fantastic. And then again, in the 60s, that was done a lot, wasn't it? It was take a film and put it on the back of the happening, you know, while everything else is happening.
Yes, McLuhan, it was notorious among his friends. He would go to a movie after about 10 minutes. He says, "Oh, I know where this is going. See ya." He never finished a movie.
Yeah.
He'd leave very quickly.
Yes, I remember Malcolm McLaren did that with... There was some famous film everyone was discussing till they were blue in the face, and I heard he walked out after 10 minutes, and I thought, "Ah, that's right, that's correct."
Would that be the movie Performance?
No, it wasn't. This is McLaren during the punk time. It might have been.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think maybe it was Tommy. Okay. He walked out of Tommy, and I so wished I had. I don't know why I stayed in there. It was so bad.
Well, the thing is, you stayed in there because the massage itself, it's like being on a drug, and you ride out the experience.
Well, I don't know if this ever affects you, Bob, or whether you're freer of these kind of trammels of being a critic, but occasionally I've sat through things I couldn't stand simply because I knew that if I left, somebody would say, "Ah, but you left just before, you know," and then they'd tell you it all got exciting, it got good, you know.
And that's what I do. I wait it out.
You sometimes have to sit there and sweat it out so that you can say nothing good happened. I can tell you I was there, you know. But I've kind of given up that idea. I used to have that idea, but I've become less of an expert, less of a technical critic, less of a know-it-all. I'm more of a person who just wants to have a good time myself and avoid the bad times. So I'm walking out now, you know?
Yeah, if I don't have the time, I'll do that. But if I have the time, I won't, because I agree with McLuhan. He said that I can find patterns anywhere, even in bad movies.
Yeah. That's true.
Okay, he wouldn't stay around if he got the pattern pretty quickly, regardless of whether it was a good movie or a bad movie. But it's the I'm pretty good at being wherever I am and working. I work every day in the sense of thinking or pattern recognition, and contradicting myself. What the heck am I looking for patterns for? You know, the ongoing drama of cognition is what I'm engaged in. It doesn't matter too much what the content is. There is better content. I mean, I enjoy listening to Out to Lunch more than some other show, and so I know I'm going to hear some music I never heard of. I never heard Shinehead before, and that was a good song you played last week, so that was new. I've had a bit of choice there. But if you were a lousy show, if you read Finnegan's Wake for most show, you know, I'll listen to it, maybe tune in and out, but that's not as exciting to me, because I think it's ridiculous listening to someone verbalize Finnegan's Wake. I can do it for a little while, but then I want to interact with it. Mm. I don't like the monologue version of Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I try and make sure Finnegan's Wake readings don't last. You know, I try and imagine the musical effect of a single voice and criticize
that. That's where your show saves itself. Yeah. If you start doing Finnegan's Wake, I'll listen for a while, then I'll move forward. I said, well, Ben's going to interrupt this with music, so I'll move forward and find the music. Oh, yeah, there it is. Good. Worth waiting. And then, oh, he's back to the Wake. Listen to a little bit. Okay, I got that. Page 14 of Finney's Wake. All right, I got to know that. All right, then move to the next song. Yeah. So, like today, I didn't listen to all of Ken Fox. And I just listened to a bit of it, and I said, well, I haven't heard Desserts in a long time, so I listened to that in the background. And then I jumped forward, and there was blessed heavy metal going on or something, and then all kinds of other stuff. So the variety, we really have the opportunity to experience variety and collage. McLuhan said collage is the only way to do art today. He said that 40, 50 years ago. But the collage thing is what we expect. And so we don't have a point of view. Only have a point of view if someone raises the rent or takes away your income. Mm. And then it has to interact with this virtual situation that what is it today that's seducing everybody? If money seduced people, what's seducing people today? Money. It's still seducing.
Well, it's funny. Money seems a pretty long-term problem. And this is why a lot of fashionable, you know, the watershed was... I use the term watershed. Nobody ever understands what I mean. What I mean is the moment at which something starts flowing in the other way. You know,
a flip point.
Yeah, a flip point, a really important flip point, you know, and people have tried to rearrange. I mean, every new thinker has got to, like, rearrange your sense of history and, you know, what happened when. And was it the French Revolution in 1789 that was really important, or was it this? And people crop up and argue. And we've had...
Yeah, they argue over the beginning of the word modern and what that points to.
Yeah, and we've had a lot of people saying that 1973 was this huge event, and as far as I can see it, it's the moment at which the 60s boom was petering out and the first kind of crisis is biting again after, you know, boom 50s, 60s, everything going up and up, and 73 is like hard times ahead. But I fit all that into capitalism. I mean, it has booms and slumps, you know, and I don't take each boom as like the beginning of a new era and each slump as, you know, the beginning of yet another new era. You know, I go... Well, booms and slumps. I mean, credit crunch did not surprise me in the slightest. I mean, the newspapers, they were absolutely amazed by credit crunch. Okay, well, this is, excuse me, haven't you read Capital? You know, it's not a rational system. All these people like lemmings all kind of decide houses are where it's at. Let's buy houses, obviously. You know, if they keep doing that, it'll become a point at which it gets ridiculous and nobody wants to pay that much for a house and the house prices will come down. You know, this is... What happens?
That's the effect of the computer. See, the computer allowed people to do this really fast, move money and buying and selling. Yeah. So the computer, everybody didn't think that the computer would flip into a obverse experience. They think that, oh, it's a new medium. It's going to be here forever. We'll ride this out forever. Yeah. And they forget. They get involved in the new medium. And I'm saying that money came in as a medium 200-300 years ago, and people forgot that it wouldn't last forever. Mm. And that it would go through all the permutations the money environment goes through. Mm. And that's the basic point that McLuhan is saying. Look at the medium, mind your awareness about it, because it's going to do you in, regardless how much
but this
fun
is,
you're having
you see,
right now.
And this is where we're in agreement, because for postmodernism, aesthetics was a kind of soft soaping of everything, that you could put on everything and allowed everything to go down easy. Whereas we are saying absolutely the opposite, that for us the aesthetic experience is grit. It's a moment where it scratches and there's friction and it stops. And that's why we value the aesthetic experience. The aesthetic experience we're talking about is this rugged, knobbly moment of everything grating to a standstill and you being able to look at it clearly, and not this kind of greasy slide and whiz that we actually find, and I could, maybe I'll try talking for us just to see how it goes, but that we actually find the slide and the whiz and the greasy, slippery, kind of airbrushed, fully 3D shaded, kind of three-dimensional thing absolutely kitsch and offensive. We don't find that artistic. That what we're looking for is this grainy thing, which is like an old bluesman grunting. And then when we get that, we think, ah, now this is the moment where something's been interrupted. I can actually look at it. And then you find the beauty in the grain. And that's kind of our aesthetic. But the point of our aesthetic is that it's an attack upon this slipperiness, which is the way the media talk and the way that money moves. And so it's actually a political thing. And I like the way you present McLuhan, because it's always insisting that modern art has a political... The modern art is not there by accident. It's there because of something about what mass media are doing. It has a complete relationship to it. It's not some other realm. It's embattled with it. It's part of mass media. It's the best moment of mass media, actually. The whole of mass media should exist to allow the critical art that we're talking about to arise.
And it does arise. It's there.
Yeah.
It's always there.
And it gets invented again, you know. I mean, when that drum and bass grime music came along, suddenly, you know, the dance music people had decided they needed to speed everything up and have false drums and it sounded vocalize. And often these things, and I go for a reason there, is that the highest moment of the technical development is to be able to reproduce what is most basic. And so it comes back to being able to vocalize and actually speak again.
Yes, I'm reminded of Salvador Dali once saying he loves it when he gets news of earthquakes and disasters. It's the same sense of appreciation of rupture. I mean, that's Virilio's.
I'm not happy with the way the conversation's going now, Bob. You brought in Dali. I am not happy with the way the conversation's going, because, you see, to me that leads to Dali and fascism, you know,
well, there you go, politics in.
Hello. You made Iris cry with your horrible Daliism, taking joy in other people's suffering. I'm not talking about joy in other people's suffering. I'm talking about joy in the moment of the system that produces the suffering grinding to a halt and being able to look at the actual surface of things. That's not the same as getting a kick out of earthquakes and destruction. You know, I find that fascistic and disgusting.
You
haven't ruptured me. You've just shown that you've got an insensitivity towards the world from your extreme aestheticism and a complete lack of intelligence in quoting Dali, who's exactly responsible for the kind of...
I was quoting Salvador Dali as a similar sense of delight in the rupture. It didn't mean that I agreed with Dali.
Well, if you look at the way Dali paints, he laid the foundations for exactly the kind of airbrush computer art that I was objecting to. You see, he's so different from Max Ernst. Max Ernst spent his time putting pieces of paper over wood and rubbing and getting to these random, natural... nothing is random, of course, in the world.
Max Ernst sucked up to Peggy Guggenheim.
Well, he might have done that, but as an artist, he produced something worth looking at.
Sucked up to Peggy Guggenheim.
This is the golden umbilical cord without which art can't exist. I'm aware of that. And Guy Debord had relationships with Peggy Guggenheim as well. But...
is that
Max
Iris
Ernst,
or Mordecai?
Max Ernst, this is Iris.
Okay, so the thing is, look, this point of the rupture and the silence comes in and you look at some process, you know, clearly for the first time, that's exactly what McLuhan said in the media of history. in the history of media, is that each medium would disrupt the whole thing and come to that epiphany point. Mm. And that's that general thing. And then I thought of Salvardelli. But Salvardelli is talking about chemical body stuff. We're talking about media dynamics, the TV body and the chip body, and how it leads to ruptures that the enthusiasts forget while they're in there. Now, once you see that, is that all that's required among the workers to see that process, or is there something to implement? And then that's where you bring in politics and how to organize a society and whether to get rid of money.
Well, because from this, I mean, the point of view I've expressed is a aesthetic reaction. It's a subjective reaction. But my idea is that by expressing that, one could find like minds, and that if the like minds coordinate and organize on the basis of trust, which you can only have if you share this aesthetic point of view that I'm talking about, you can actually intervene and do things. But we need to get in touch with each other.
Yeah, so I say that Finnegan's Wake is rock and roll in print. Now, you have said that before, apparently.
Not exactly. I've. You see, rock and roll for me is too much of a demotic thing, whereas Joyce is a very special single thing. So I prefer saying that Zappa's oeuvre is the completion of Joyce's project. That saying,
so Zappa is rock and roll.
I mean, I find this something very paradoxical because, you know, Deliver Me from the Days of Old, that rock and roll isn't in print. So putting it into print just sounds like the opposite of what rock and roll is.
The effect of rock and roll and rock, and electrifying music, that McLuhan studied, and you celebrate some of it, Joyce predicted that by making a book that mimed what was coming. Because you can't read Finnegan's Wake, you can dance to it.
Yeah, well, exactly, that you can dance to it. This is, I find it crucial to emphasize this, that about Finnegan's Wake, that it is sheer linguistic pleasure. And this is maybe why I read too much of it on my show, because for me, all books have something lacking because they're not Finnegan's Wake. They're not giving me, as a reader, enough grist on my tongue and changes between different letters and challenges about pronunciation. They're not giving me enough. Finnegan's Wake at last has enough in it, in every phrase, to give me verbal animal delight in pronouncing it, which is a musical delight, which is not a conceptual delight, although what's amazing is that the concepts are never quite, the string on the balloon is never quite cut. The balloons are also, the concepts are still there, and Joyce is aware of that and shaping that too. That's another level of Finnegan's Wake. But the density of linguistic invention and play going on at the level of the syllables leaves me disappointed with most other reading. And the only place I can find something equivalent would be in the extraordinary documentation of extreme vocals, which has been done in popular music.
So
the vowel sounds of Hank Williams or Iggy Pop or the extraordinary Bob Dylan. You know, I mean, I think the guy who tried to justify Bob Dylan as literature written down is so barking up the wrong tree, because the whole point about Dylan is he's a fantastic singer. He's another Frank Sinatra. That's how to listen to him. His delivery is amazing. And it's in there, and the way he twists his vowel sounds, that his art is. And I think Finnegan's Wake is the only book I know that is... has understood the amount of inflictions which vowel sounds and consonants are going to be given by recording, by radio and popular music. And that's why... So I sort of agree with your rock and roll in print, although I put it round that way.
I'd put it this way. You know of some of the scholars who've commented on Finnegan's Wake as predicting the atomic bomb. You've heard of that, right?
I think we'll have to deal with this next week, because we're really out of minutes. We're really over time, Bob.
Okay.
H-bomb next week. Bye,
okay,
Bob.
Thanks, Ben.